Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
What say you, Richard Pellett Murdoch? Are you guilty or not guilty of the felonies wherein you stand indicted?
Not guilty.
How shall you be tried?
By God and my country.
The exact time when Paul and Maggie Murdoch were murdered.
At the end of the investigation, it was obvious.
I'm not here to work with them, okay?
And the whole point is to have this not fall into the wrong hands. This case is unique, it's unprecedented in South Carolina history.
My son was in a boat wreck months back. He's been getting threats.
Welcome to Unsolved South Carolina, the Murdoch Murders, Money and Mystery. This is a daily recap, and we are here with our exclusive legal analyst, Charlie Condon, South Carolina's former attorney general. Our executive producer, Drew Tripp, is here, as is manning the boards back there is Max Harrison, our chief photographer. And he is also going to be keeping an eye on your questions. So if you have any questions for us tonight, we're streaming on several fronts. So we certainly want to try and get to it if we can. A lot happened today. And I want to start with some breaking news. We have heard from sources close to the defense that Alec Murdoch, the defendant, is considering taking the stand. Mm-hmm. This is just a consideration. This is certainly not something set in stone. Nothing, I've learned, in this case is set in stone. Until they're actually up on the witness stand, I'm not going to believe anything.
Yeah.
What do you think are the chances?
It could be a trial balloon, much like the balloons we're seeing over America.
Right
now.
Right,
we'll
exactly.
See if they stay up or get shot down. We'll see.
Yeah. And do you think it's, I've heard strong feelings about this from different, attorneys out there talking about it. What do you think? Do you think that's a good idea to do that?
Well, I'd be really surprised if he testifies. Having said that, though, he does seem to have a really strong personality, this defendant, and he may himself be, he's an accomplished trial attorney. Mm-hmm. He may feel like that's his best way forward for him to testify. So, in a way, it may not surprise me, but just generally speaking, looking at the evidence, I would think the prosecution could do a lot with cross-examination here.
Wow, yeah, there's a lot of things with that timeline I'm sure they'd love to ask Alec Murdoch about. Drew, what do you think?
I can't. It's not apples to apples, mm-hmm. but I can only share the anecdote that's coming to mind for me, which is the Russell Lafitte federal bank fraud mm-hmm. case several months back, mm-hmm. back in November, which is tangential, maybe not even so much tangential as mm-hmm. directly tied to what we're dealing with here with Alec Murdoch. That case, very much not like this one, because it wasn't circumstantial evidence. It was very, very much direct evidence and strong direct evidence to the point many of us covering the trial were asking at points leading up to when it became clear that Lafitte was going to take the stand. Is like, why didn't he take a plea deal? What is going on here? This is so lopsided. Mm-hmm. I can't stress to you enough, if you were not there, if you weren't watching it, and nobody was watching it except for the journalists there because there was not a live feed for the mm-hmm. Lafitte trial. If you weren't there, you cannot appreciate how strong a witness for himself Russell Lafitte was.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
interesting.
Was he being 100% truthful? That's debatable, and I don't think the mountain of evidence against him could be overcome when it came time for the jury to make their decision. But for the first little while, when he first got up there and started telling his side of the story, he was very, very, very believable. So
Could it work out, although what happened to Russell Lafitte at the end?
He was found guilty.
Right.
But
so
for a fleeting moment,
he
interjected that doubt that's so critical.
Okay.
And you also can't discount the fact that there was some serious hangups with that jury for Lafitte late into the night. Eventually they did, but it took some doing.
And that's all they want is to raise that reasonable doubt, right? Well, let's go back to these videos. Okay, so at the very beginning of this, if you're on our video stream, you can see it, but we'll describe it to you a little bit. We received the redacted versions of the body camera video from officers, first responding officers to the murder scene, as well as SLED agents who went in the following day to do some investigation and discovery work. Now, these body camera videos, the one that we played at the very top of this show, was to give you an idea. You hear Alec Murdoch's voice on, and literally this is who the first responder for the Colleton County Sheriff's Office, Daniel Green, is getting out of his car. He literally walks up. He is not 1 minute into his body camera video on the ground at this murder scene, and Alec Murdoch launches into basically why he thinks these killings occurred, right, which was a moment. And that is something that is, you know, we're now able to actually kind of put the visual and the audio together. The other thing we got to see is the actual crime scene. You feel like you're walking through this crime scene. I said this tonight in our story. You feel like you're walking through this crime scene with the officers, and it's an eerie feeling. It's dark. You can feel how they're assessing the danger near them. Who's here? What are they doing here? And then this defendant who is talking to them quite a bit. And then we're able to see a bit more. But as far as this, being able to look at this redacted crime scene, how effective is it to be able to now use these body camera videos for, I mean, I can see how the state and the defense, I'll be honest, could use this quite effectively.
That's a good point. We're in a new world now with just courts in general. All these officers throughout the country, and certainly here in South Carolina, they have these body-worn cameras that record
everything,
all sorts of information. Yeah. And it did seem to be helpful in terms of painting the scene. Both good and bad, possibly, for the state, because the defense did make some good points relative to crime scene preservation. But it set the scene very nicely, I think, for these jurors to get a flavor. Earlier the defense talked about a crime scene visit. I'm not so sure the judge would allow it at this point. What do you think? Because we have so much information about
it. You know,
that.
As soon as I saw the crime scene video, that's exactly what I was thinking about, too. I was like, why are we going to the crime scene? Like, it's not going to be dark when they go to the crime scene, so you can't really revisit what it felt like that night, unless they do it at nighttime, I guess. I guess they could do that. But I could see them saying, no, let's just move forward with all of this body camera video we have. But what do you think, Drew?
I don't know. I'm not sure that we also got to remember, right, that this, they've seen this body camera video now 2 weeks ago.
Oh, that's a really good point, Drew. I'm sorry I didn't say that earlier. The jury saw this the first day of testimony with Daniel Green, and they didn't see the redacted versions. They saw what it looked like when they saw the body, so it's much more shocking than what we're seeing. That's a really good point, but go ahead, Drew. Sorry.
I just... For the shock value of... And Charlie, you can speak to this and what you're trying to accomplish in a trial. And I know that's a fine line you're walking there with. You're trying to impress upon a jury the sheer horror of and just brutality of what they're seeing, for the effect of convincing them of the seriousness, right, of what they're dealing with.
And I don't know if we're going to jump to this or not, but the autopsy photos shown to these jurors today, mission accomplished on that. We can talk about that later.
We can talk about it now, because it does kind of segue to that. And we can loop back to a couple things.
I think what happened this afternoon here in Walterboro, it's in my experience, becoming a rarity in South Carolina, because typically in a murder prosecution, yes, they have all sorts of photos of the gruesome crime scene and photos of the autopsy. And typically, I don't know what the redacted saw. The unredacted body cam, I think I may have saw a glimpse of that accidentally, but it wasn't as
You saw as it gruesome. When they were playing it for the jury?
I think I may have caught a glimpse of that. And I must say, the glimpse I caught also, and my... trying to violate any court orders. I'm just sitting there, and these things may flash in front of one's eye. And
so we just couldn't help ourselves at times.
The autopsy photos, let me paint the scene here. a little bit about this because I had a capital case reverse called State versus Middleton because yours truly put in some gruesome photographs, particularly one over a defense objection, and the judge allowed it. That was reversed on appeal, so I had to retry that case. And so the standard, if the defense objects to photographs that are unduly prejudicial, and you can prove your point either by not using them or by using black and white, they're not coming in. Well, what's very unusual in this case, it's clear to me, of course, the state wanted to put them in to show the gruesome nature of the gravity of the crime as well as the cause and manner of death.
But and we're talking about autopsy photos.
Yeah.
So that was another part of the testimony that we heard today was from the pathologist who was sharing
Dr.
autopsy.
Dr. Reimer from the MUSC. She was excellent. So
telling us exactly how Paula Maggie died.
She finished her direct examination.
She didn't hold back.
No, she finished direct examination. She cross-examined Maura. But the defense, clearly, they could have kept these photographs out. They did not want to. I'm convinced they didn't want them out because they believe through their focus group that jurors will have a hard time believing that the defendant would so gruesomely murder his wife and son. And these photographs speak for themselves. And so to paint the scene here, she testified 5,500 autopsies, highly qualified, testified in court, an expert several hundred times.
She was like a professor in it. She was amazing.
Didn't bother her in the least, of course, these photographs. But it was once some of the photographs of Paul Murdoch were shown, I can just tell you that several of the jurors just really, one in particular, but really two, really one, I guess you'd have to say she broke down in tears. Judge Newman saw that and wisely and appropriately ordered a break. And not to say that the other jurors weren't affected, but they were a bit more stoic in their appearance. So we had this break, and
this was just Paul. Like, Paul. They'd only gone through Paul's, but what she talked about with Paul and the way they had to sort of visualize what happened to Paul, I think was more than some of them could bear.
Well, I think the exact photograph, not to get graphic on this podcast, but the one that I think got the great reaction was apparently was a photograph of his head, skull, without the brain in it. And I understand from the testimony the brain was delivered separately to the autopsy room. So
that's
photograph
very
really,
hard to hear.
Yeah, and these jurors are here to fulfill their civic duty. And I felt really sorry for them in that they had to really suffer through this. Mm-hmm. We didn't have to suffer. We didn't look at it. I'm certain that there's some people not sleeping well tonight because of their jury duty. And, you know, God bless them for being willing to do this and to undergo what they are undergoing and to fulfill their civic duty. And I just felt for them. Anyhow, after that break, we had the continuation of it with like those photographs in, but then we had Maggie. And I think by then...
Nothing like a mom.
Oh.
I mean...
And then I do know that, you know, not to single out a particular juror, but there was how do you handle a stressful situation like that? Well, you avert, right? And so there was some aversion of looking at the information. It was described very graphically, and it was just a very touching moment to have to see really people suffer that were there trying to fulfill their civic duty. But point made, I have no doubt that these jurors now completely understand just how horrific these murders were, and I'm sure the defense will try and we use that to say that they're so horrific. Can you imagine why would this, for money troubles, why would Alec Murdoch do this to his son and wife?
Yeah, I mean, it was resounding, and it was also a show from Alec Murdoch. The defendant was very, was grieving and crying and really, there was a lot of emotion right there, right? And then... also his family, because his family's now been moved to the back row for various reasons that we're still kind of hearing about a little bit. But for whatever reason, Buster and Lynn and John Marvin and Liz, his wife, John Marvin's wife, were all in the back row.
I remember looking back and Buster hung his head too.
They were suffering.
It was a tough afternoon.
Just hearing about the mom and the brother. Yep.
I made it a point to look at Buster. And Alec at different times going through the autopsy testimony. Buster wouldn't look at it, and God knows who could blame him. But he sat kind of hunched forward
with his head down.
With his head down, looking at the ground. He'd look up. If he looked up, he wasn't looking anywhere near the direction of where the witness stand was, because you had Creighton Waters and this medical examiner over there giving demonstrative, they were being demonstrative in their descriptions of what happened. They were getting a dowel rod out and showing bullet trajectories and their pantomiming.
Yeah, and that was, yeah, that was fascinating, wasn't it? Because you could, the testimony would be that Paul Murdoch, you had the initial close range shotgun blast, close range because of stippling, so 2 to 3 feet away, that didn't kill him. Mm-hmm. She testified that she expected him to be standing. And then the second shot where he, and that was basically towards the front, and no defensive wounds, arms down, which mean you would argue, I'm sure, the state that he knew the person, wasn't right. afraid of him. And then the second shot, the fatal one, which blew his head out, his brains out, not to be too graphic, that would have been also relatively close. I don't think she really got into the stippling because it was such a mess, I guess, really.
Yes.
And then, boom, he falls down, abrasions to the face. That was the fatal blow. And then with Maggie, what was fascinating to me, 5 wounds total, but she couldn't say whether
it could be four
because one could have gone through her wrist
because she was holding
and she
her
went through hand. Yeah, just to briefly talk about this, that she went through how the first couple were in the front, and then this is fascinating how there was one bullet that went upwards in her body through her left breast up into her head. How could that happen? Well, she then theorized that that Maggie had to be bent over from pain from the first initial shots with her body bending over. That's how the shot then went through her breast up into her head. But then the last shot was a shot that went through the skull downward. How could that happen? She testified that it was her best opinion that she was then on the ground with that shot that would have been basically the last kill shot, even though the next to last shot would have been fatal as well. So it was very graphic. It was really hard to listen to.
And to hear that, I think the worst part for me was to hear that Maggie suffered, and for her family to have to hear that Maggie suffered like that, because she was very clear. The pathologist did not hold back.
She was very clear
that Maggie was in pain, and that was hard for everybody.
Compared it to kidney stones, that sort of a pain.
Yeah, and that just, you know, but this is a murder trial, and I think that's absolutely the levity of the situation. I don't think
gravity.
The state's, yeah, they're not going to hold back.
Right. But what I will say again, just to reiterate this legal point, which I think is important, typically, you're not seeing these photographs. The defense could have easily kept them out, because all of that could have been explained either in black and white photographs. Even those might not have been necessary. It could have been done through that cardboard image that she was using.
Sure.
And it's very clear, and it was a strategic decision on both sides. The state wanted them in,
right,
and the defense welcomed them in. And I don't mean in a gleeful manner, because everyone was very somber. But that was a very telling strategic decision to me, and we'll see how it plays out effectively on both sides. But it was quite the afternoon.
Yeah.
Well, and it may not be a surprise that that's when I started to get to hear inkling that maybe Alec Murdoch would take the stand.
Yeah, they might have thrown that out there at the same time, which,
a little troubling.
Right.
Go ahead.
To segue into our next point that we want to talk about, backing up to one of our earlier episodes and where something that I put out there, sort of a theory on why, to Charlie's point, the defense is not objecting to some of this stuff and allowing it in. One quick thing before that, I mentioned the double-edged sword or the fine line you're walking. The importance of the body camera video that we're now just seeing 2 weeks into it that's been released, the jury gets to see body language. They get to see how Alec was acting, right? That's certainly a major portion of it. They get to hear the tone of his voice. They get to read body language, the thing that's invaluable in human communication that can't be understated, how, because it says so much without saying a spoken word. That's one point to seeing it. But on the other side of that, into the gruesomeness and the graphic nature of what we're seeing, point I made a while back, and I think it's still quite clear this is what's happening. The defense isn't objecting because they feel like they're making a solid point of their own in that there's no way he could have gone through all this and been so intimately involved with these just awful, awful murders and come away with not a shred of blood, a drop of blood on him. And that leads us into what we heard today regarding the DNA analysis and the blood spatter, or not blood spatter. We did hear about blood spatter, but specifically blood swabs and blood sample analysis.
Peters.
Yes.
So male DNA under her fingernails, not from Paul, not from Alec Murdoch.
The foreign DNA to her, yes. They were excluded as contributors. 74?
74. And in your test, on none of these did you detect human blood with hematuris. Is that correct?
For all those cuttings for the different items, they were all put together into that tube for that item. And for all of those tests, the result was negative.
So we're 0 for 74 in detecting human blood here.
The result was negative.
That was the defense attorney, Phil Barber, doing a little cross-examination. Well, what do we think? This is DNA that they're trying to, they're trying to say that there's blood on the t-shirt. That's what the 74 is all about, right?
Yes.
So they're trying to say that there were 74 times it was tested, 74 times it was found not to have blood on it. And this goes back to information that was getting somehow leaked out. They even bring it up in the testimony today that we've been hearing about high velocity blood spatter on a white t-shirt or on a t-shirt that Alec Murdoch, the defendant, was wearing. Now we're slowly seeing this trickle in to our testimony into the trial. It is still totally unclear how the state's going to handle this, in my opinion. Anyone?
Well, great question, but maybe I can put a little bit of context here in terms of the morning, because talk about a juxtaposition, right? We had, what was it, 3 or 4 hours of very boring DNA testimony.
Mm-hmm. And that was the other thing, like just keeping those jurors awake
and
this morning.
Yeah, Monday morning, we thought we'd have Eddie Smith, right? But no, it was like, no, the most. And I think what was going on there from the state standpoint is what I call the CSI effect, in that they wanted to show that they did all this DNA gathering, because if they didn't show the jurors this, the defense would say they didn't even do DNA. And so we did have, I don't know, was it 4 or 5 hours of DNA with the probabilities? I learned some new words on how high zeros could get. Was it 32 zeros at the end?
48 was the highest. I feel like I remember hearing 48 zeros.
So, and that apparently is the way SLED does it now, and that they don't say it's a match. They say this is the percentage. And so once you get to whatever 30 zeros, it's a match in my mind. But anyhow, the what I got from all that, it was pretty boring stuff in terms of it being anything of a gotcha moment, other than a little bit on the fingernail, in which you have that sound clip.
Absolutely. Well, you want to talk about that?
Well, I'm sure the state will say, well, she testified, it can come from all sorts of sources. The defense will say, that's who did it, right? But there
but
were
it
no defenses.
It wasn't a lot. It was like 30 wheels or something?
Yeah, and also
three alleles. Three alleles of DNA.
Three alleles. Yeah. Not 30. It's
which the way it was described was an incomplete.
Right.
If you can think of DNA like a links in a chain, it was one link of a chain, and it was an incomplete chain.
Right.
And it was just a very small sample size.
But it was enough to just, again, like maybe one person think, why did she have somebody else's DNA underneath her fingernail? Right.
But so, she said DNA.
But it could be nothing.
Could be touching it. Right. And also, I will say that the forensic pathologist said there was no forensic, there was no defensive wounds on Maggie whatsoever. So whoever it was at a distance, so it wasn't like she's scratching at somebody or anything like that. But anyhow, to get to your question relative to the blood, I don't have a short answer for that. I'm assuming that'll be tied up at the end as to why there was so much information or evidence gathering on the shirt that hasn't panned out, really, right? Would you say that?
Yeah, and the backstory on the shirt, for those who aren't totally familiar, it's the white t-shirt. Speaking of the body camera footage, it's the white t-shirt Alec is seen wearing and has been seen in photos up before now until all the videos got released today. It's the white T-shirt that was tested multiple times. We found out today just how many times tested for blood. It was tested in multiple ways. First, they used something I believe called Hematrace. And then the Hematrace testing came back negative, as they said, 74 times for blood. And then apparently SLED agents after the fact came back behind this forensic analyst who did the testing and found no blood on the shirt. And they tested it again with a chemical solution called LCV, leukocrystal violet, which glows purple. Basically, if it reacts with blood, it glows a certain violet, which is in the name, and you can test it for blood. However, it's in direct conflict. They noted how there's all these things that can contaminate it, right? The explanation given is that the Hematrace is more precise, but it's not as strong. It's not as powerful, whereas the LCV is more powerful, but it's not as precise, meaning that LCV can react with human blood, fish blood. They even made that point about
bleach.
All sorts of contaminants that could give a false reading for blood with this LCV testing. Right. And they doused the shirt in it. Not just the samples that they cut away, they doused the shirt in it. It's completely covered in blood, thus rendered there can be no further testing on the shirt now that they've put
it. And I thought Attorney Barber threw out the most logical explanation, perhaps, is that the shirt was the logo of a fishing boat, right? And so could that have been fish blood?
Yeah.
Oh.
It was a perfectly logical explanation.
What happened before we ever started this trial was the defense was just up in arms about the fact that they weren't able to test this shirt because it had gotten doused with LCV. And they were like, we want this like thrown out of court. We don't want to fight this. We can't even look at it with our own experts, which is by law, they are right to be able, I'm looking at you. I'm like, I got this right. Right. talking to the law here.
Yeah. Not to bore anybody with this, but if the evidence is spoiled by the state,
right.
Depending on how critical it is, the defense can use it to its advantage. I think that'd be a fair statement.
Okay. Well, so the issue now is we've heard a lot about him changing clothes. So everybody's wondering, because there was that 74 times they tested it and nothing came up on this T-shirt, is the state going to let go of this white T-shirt and just move on to he changed clothes? And it feels like that's where they're going.
I don't know yet.
They may still say, well, you had it on underneath, or I don't know what they're going to say. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about the other issue going on in that courtroom right now that is making everybody a little anxious. And that is that two jurors today had to be dismissed.
COVID.
Yep, we've got COVID in the courtroom, and we've got COVID within some of the court employees. So we're dealing with that. Mm-hmm. And we've got two jurors out in a very small area where they've been sitting with everybody. There's been no masks, pretty much. Maybe two of them have worn a mask every once in a while. So we have, as of now, three alternates to pick from in case anybody else goes down.
Right.
So if we don't, we're just going to have to cross our fingers here.
And
right?
Also thought it was interesting, of course, this is South Carolina, right? So the court strongly encouraged everyone to wear a mask. And I hate to laugh about it because it's not funny people getting COVID, but I didn't see many masks being worn. Did you? Even though they were encouraged.
Not a ton.
There were a few.
They were passing out. I got one.
Yeah.
So I did wear one got one and a couple of the reporters I was sitting with, but they kind of ran out of masks within.
Do you notice how that
so we'll have to get our own now.
Right. Yeah. A lot of people started wearing them as the day wore on. They didn't. So
yeah.
I don't know where that's going to end up tomorrow with.
Well, and also they said they weren't going to worry about social distancing. That was another
suggestion. The court wasn't going to order that. Said that, hey, people worried about COVID, they can stay at home, they can watch it on TV, so they're taking the risk. From a legal standpoint, I didn't get a chance to ask Attorney Harputlin this, but remember last week he moved for a mistrial?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
And today he was really trying hard to keep the jury intact, so there wouldn't be a mistrial. So I was fascinated by that change of legal position.
Because Harputlin intimated that it cost them a fortune. It was costing them a fortune to do this case, which not at all disagreeing with. And Charlie, you could probably give more, if we had more time, you could give more insight into the expenses that go into defending a case and trying or prosecuting a case. But there was the headline that made the rounds over the weekend about where Harpootlian and the defense camp are staying here in Gallatin County. This wedding.
Are you familiar with the venue?
Yeah. I mean, I've passed by it all my life. I don't think it hasn't always been mm-hmm. what it is now, but it's a wedding venue essentially, mm-hmm. or a wedding reception venue. You can have your wedding there as well, but it's a five homes, I believe, in an mm-hmm. event space with just beautiful landscaping, right. lots of acreage. It's yeah. kind of a little retreat that you yeah. want to go for your wedding. Eden yeah. at Gracefield is yeah. what it's called.
I did hear that if you added up the cost of hotel rooms for the defense team, that the cost was in the ballpark comparable. Yeah.
I'm sure.
People tried to charge us $5,000 a week for an apartment coming in before this trial.
Yeah.
I'm not throwing any names out there, but
yeah, there were some opportunities. It was getting expensive. Well, let's hit one more thing before we go, because we did get word this morning that they were going to go back in and look at some of the data coming off the GPS system on Alex's vehicle.
Yes, that was interesting.
And that was fascinating. So just as we end this today, we just might hit this one more point. We had a lot going on today, even though it felt like a Monday, you know, with a slow start. We ended up ramping up and get going. The OnStar data was incomplete, even though they spent a year trying to open the OnStar data and reverse engineered it in order to get what they got as far as the data points of when he started his car, when it went into park, when it got to his mom's house, all this stuff. So we've already heard all that. Now we learned that when GM heard from the testimony that they couldn't open up this OnStar data, they were like, oh, well, hold on, I got the key. So they come in and they've got this trove of data now. And, you know, the defense is like, well, when are we supposed to look at all this? I felt sorry for them.
Well, I can
and
only...
And for the state. I mean, that's a lot.
Well, what I thought might have been going on, can't you just see some executive GM? What do you mean we don't have OnStar data? Go find it.
Yeah. And it was clear. What do you mean they can't open our OnStar?
No one made an issue about the state hiding anything. It was newly discovered evidence. I thought Attorney Harpootlian had a nice quip. As much money we gave them, they should have been able to come up with it earlier.
What did he say?
As much money GM has gotten, they should have been from the government. They should have been able to come up with it faster, something along those lines.
Yeah, it was talking referencing the auto industry bailouts from.
So it's probably going to get the shares to plummet now.
So where we're left with, though, but Prosecutor Waters did represent to the court this wouldn't slow him down. He thought the information was entirely consistent with their timeline. I think the defense takes a different view, but he says that he can end his case this, not tomorrow, but the next day. We'll see.
Yeah, wow. And I think the reason he said that, and he was very clear today, Creighton, was that this data is confirmatory rather mm-hmm. than revelatory. Right. It's more exact, more precise data that they're going to be getting from this rather than anything new and groundbreaking, so they can be more confident in what they're saying.
Great. Well, we have got a lot to look forward to this week. Let's hope everybody stays healthy and well, and we can continue on with this trial. And we will find out what they have in store for us tomorrow. Thank you so much for joining us. If you have questions, we didn't really answer any questions today. We had so much information to give out, but please leave us questions so we can get back to you as soon as possible. So for Ann, Charlie, Drew, Max, we'll see you tomorrow night. Thank you.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.